Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Talking Rugby Union podcast. My name is Joe Harvey. I'm the host, and I'm going to be joined today by three men who are going to be talking with me about essentially rugby business and rugby law with everything that's going on in the world at the minute. Things are a bit uncertain about salary cap, returning to training, contracts and player welfare. I'm joined, as ever, by the one and only Chris Heal.
That's some introduction, Joe. How's things, mate?
Yeah, it's all right. I've not done a podcast for a while. I've had three espresso shots. Well, six, technically, all together. And I'm kind of raring to go. So I'm quite excited. I've not done a podcast in a while.
No, it's good to get one on. I've got a feeling that with time, this when Premiership Rugby might actually say something in the next 24 hours. But it's good to get a pod out there anyway.
Yeah, definitely. That's probably why I'm talking quite quickly at the minute. Definitely not the espresso. Right, okay. So we are joined by Rugby and the Law blog, Ben Cisneros, and former player and author of best-selling book Fringes, as well as a former TRU contributor, well, current TRU contributor, Ben Mercer. Boys, how are we?
Good, thanks. Thanks very much for having me on.
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. I didn't realise I'd been fired from TRU, but cheers, Joe.
Well, I just couldn't remember the last time that you'd written something. It would have been promo for the book, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it was a while ago, so yeah, I'll give you that.
Well, I've seen you in so many publications recently, Ben. It's difficult to know who you write for these days.
It's gone big time. It's gone big time for us.
Yeah, it's gone very big time. Rugby Journal the other day, I saw.
Yeah, I was only guesting on there, you know. So I always remember who gave me my big break.
Well, the way I marker it is if you have a picture of yourself in the Rugby Journal, that's a pretty good marker of where you are in the world.
Have you got a copy? They didn't send me a copy.
All right. I did have a copy and I left it at the farm because I'm an idiot. But no, we're going to be, as I said kind of in the intro, we're going to be talking about player welfare, contracts, returning to training, salary cap. And that's kind of not just talking about the top flight in this country, as well as we're going to be looking at, I suppose, the Championship downwards as well, the national leagues in particular, where players do earn, well, can earn a fairly decent living from playing rugby. So we might as well kick off. And I think I'm going to ask, I'll leave this as kind of an open one to everyone in the call. Do we all want rugby to return? And do we now think it's actually possible to complete the Premiership season?
I'll jump in on that. Sorry. I mean, I think we all want rugby to return, don't we? From the sort of fans' perspective, we all want to watch rugby again. We all want to enjoy rugby. So from that perspective, I think the answer is definitely yes. I think the bigger question is whether it would be sensible for it to return, whether it would be safe for it to return. And I think there's a lot more doubt over that. Of course, also from a commercial sense, I think we probably want rugby to come back as soon as possible so that the game can secure its financial longevity, because the longer this goes on, the more damage is going to be inflicted in a commercial sense.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Everyone wants to get back playing. I'm sure players, you're kind of quite happy to have a rest for a bit, but the longer it goes on, the kind of longer they're sort of detrained, the longer it'll take them to get prepared to play. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, most of the other sort of leagues have canned, you know, the rest of their year, and someone was saying the other day about potentially 8 weeks for sort of prep required for return to play. And if you take that, then that would essentially run you through to August and you might as well kick off the next season. So it's I'm sure we all know, it's a very difficult situation to be in. And it's not a sport like football or basketball where you could play every few days and just cram a load of games in. It's just impossible.
Yeah, I think I echo both Ben's points there. I mean, you know, from our perspective, Joe, obviously we want, I think for all four of us, we want rugby to return because it's, you know, such a massive part of our lives. And, you know, I know when lockdown started that Darren Giles was saying that he wanted rugby to be the first sport back on TV. And, you know, it's been a very, very slow process, but hopefully over the next week or so, we do get a bit more transparency on it because, yeah, as Ben Mercer just said, Ben, it is sort of different to football and basketball in a way because of the nature of the game. And I guess they do have to take all these measures into account, but you know, it seems that they've been waiting for the government to talk to them before making any decision. And hopefully with Boris's announcement next week, we do get a bit more decisiveness from the people at the top of the game.
Yeah, of course. And before any player has to go out on the pitch, they have to reach a certain kind of level of fitness and all that kind of stuff. So returning to training is the key thing. Obviously, Sale Sharks had a bit of a misfire on Monday, from what I understand. Returning to play. So there's a stage two of elite sport return to training in place now, but there's no clarification from Premiership Rugby in particular about when that's going to be. Ben, what was the rules when you were playing? Did you have to complete a certain amount of stuff when... Well, sorry, Ben Mercer. Oh, this is going to get confusing after a while for
me. It's all right. When you mentioned about playing, it was quite clear it was not me.
Fair enough. And was there a certain rule or a certain like amount of stuff you had to do before you could even step out on the field for a pre-season game?
I actually don't know whether there was something regulatory, but yeah, I think in terms of the team would want you obviously in a certain condition. And I mean, it's just because this is such a novel situation. It's never come up. And having said that, you know, if you turn up at a league, you know, you might be coming from abroad. You might've come from, say someone's played the Australian season, they jump in. This is something I did at Cornish Pirates. I played the Australian season, had our kind of end of season couple of weeks, nursing a little bit of a niggle, trying to kind of recover that. Came over and signed a contract with the Cornish Pirates, which started in October or November time. And they're very much like, you know, get on the field, pal. And so I don't think there's anything regulatory in that respect. But yeah, obviously people want people in the best condition they can be in and all the rest. But yeah, I don't think there's any sort of actual, this is how you must be.
No, and just to reiterate that, I'm pretty sure there's not any regulations on any fixed window of training that has to be. There is guidelines, well, not guidelines, there are rules about a necessary break between the end of one season and another, but I don't think that's to do with the amount of prep time. It's more about the amount of time off. So no, I think it's very much up in the air from that perspective anyway.
I think there'll be quite a variance as well in terms of who comes back in what state. So I think the other day there was a Bode Barrett, you know, he broke their Bronco record at the Auckland Blues. He's obviously been doing loads of running and his time off, but I'm pretty certain there'll be a few blokes who haven't done any running and they'll come back and, you know, maybe they'll set some worst ever mark for certain fitness tests. So that's the other thing, is that, yeah, there'll be such a variance in how everyone presents themselves at clubs, which happens normally, you know, like people come back for pre-season in wildly different states. But as Ben was saying, there's a kind of, I think it's a 5 week downtime that you're meant to have, I think. But
yeah.
Blown well past that. So yeah. It's the longest break anyone's ever had.
Yeah, I mean, Dane Cole said that. We spoke to him on TRU last week and he was saying, yeah, this is the longest pre-season I've ever had. And he said, you know, it's all about trying to keep on top of the fitness. And I think that just helps with in terms of their overall player welfare as well. I think you probably know that, Ben, as well, that, you know, keeping active and keeping fit and going to training and seeing your mates as much as you can and keeping in contact with them is the best these players can do at the moment. And obviously that's been tough for them, not being able to go to training. So hopefully that changes for them over the next couple of weeks.
I think one of the things as well, when you're doing, you know, like hard fitness work, and my sister lives with a GB Paralympic rower and they've had to train, you know, they've got a rowing machine, but they're on their own. The squad's on a Zoom call. And you just don't get that vibe that you get from the group. You know, when you're in a group and it's pushing yourself and, you know, rugby is a high-performance sport and you want guys in the best state possible. But actually, psychologically, to really test yourself like that on your own at home is quite difficult. And, you know, you don't have the noise. You don't have people cheering you on. You don't have all the sort of bum taps, you know. You don't have any of that. And, like, that would be a real challenge for everybody, I think.
I was just going to add in about the gap, going back to what was mentioned about the mandatory time off. So you're right, Ben, there's a mandatory five-week rest after the end of the season, which means you have to have 2 weeks of absolute rest. So that's like basically doing nothing, going on holiday, whatever. 3 weeks of active rest, which is sort of returning to some sort of physical activity. And then the rule about the gap between the seasons is there normally has to be a 12-week gap. So I suppose if you take the 5 away from the 12, that leaves a 7-week pre-season, sort of in its proper sense anyway. So maybe that could be a guide as to what's the normal period. I mean, what do you think about that, Ben? Is 7 weeks normal or could it be done in less, do you think?
I think, yeah, they usually take a bit longer because the first couple of weeks they're trying to, you know, at least 2 weeks, they're normally trying to pack size on people depending on the state they present in. And then there's obviously preseason games as well. So there's normally, you know, you need time for a couple of matches before you start the season in earnest. And then there's obviously now the amount of time that would take, you know, that would then encroach on another season. And what do they do? I don't know.
I don't think anyone knows.
Now, obviously there's been very little kind of conversation from Premiership Rugby or PRL in terms of when things are going to come back. Are they waiting for other people to kind of make their decisions for them? What do you think is the main kind of fears and concerns of PRL in terms of bringing back rugby, which we've not seen now since March?
Yeah, if I could just jump in on that. With regard to the guidance that they're receiving and the decisions they're making, I mean, obviously they were waiting for quite a while, I think, to have some sort of go-ahead from government on any sort of return to training or to play. And they've had that from the government guidance stage one and now stage two as well. They've issued these two bits of guidance about how we can return to elite sport. And Premiership Rugby did put out a statement a week ago today, actually, on the 21st, saying that, you know, it's taking longer than expected to assess how they're going to go about implementing this guidance. So this was after the stage one guidance had come out, which it was a bit of an odd statement to make in a way, I suppose, because other leagues, for example, the Premier League, were very quick to act, and they've produced some incredibly detailed guidance on exactly how training can resume, and actually individual training has resumed. So this was what was allowed under stage one, was individual training or training in very small groups where everyone's kept apart. And then of course stage two guidance came out, I think it was beginning of this week. I'm losing track of the days in this lockdown, but I think it was beginning of this week. And we haven't heard anything from rugby since. So I agree with you, it's surprising that we haven't heard more about what exactly they're doing to implement this. I think cost is a big reason for that. And the amount of hoops they're going to have to jump through, because this guidance sort of requires there to be detailed risk assessments carried out, to have nominated officers, sort of medical officers dealing with everything COVID related. And then you have to have the space to spread out your training group. You have to organise who's coming in when. You've got to work out who's cleaning what equipment, how often it's going to be cleaned. You know, it is a real minefield. And then stage two, when you're allowed to return to contact training, you can only do that if you've already gone through the stage one process. So the fact that presumably Premiership clubs haven't gone through stage one yet means they can't move on to stage two. And then, of course, stage two brings another set of hurdles for them to get over. And one of the big things, I think, is testing, because I think any return to play system is going to need some level of COVID-19 testing. And the Premier League have seemed to have got that up and running. But that must come at a considerable cost. You know, I had a quick look yesterday at what a private healthcare test costs, and the lowest I could find was about 200 quid. So if you're doing, if it's, let's say, around that per time, so per test of, you know, presumably every player in the league, and I think it was required that they do it at least twice a week, for example, you know, the bill for that is going to pretty quickly escalate. So I think cost is a big one. And of course, the cost of also implementing all those other protocols that I mentioned is probably one of the reasons we've seen the delay.
Yeah, I think that's what you're talking about before, Ben. It is different to football, because we know how much money there is in football, don't we? And the commercial side of the game. And we saw that yesterday, I think the Telegraph released that BT are hoping to pay out for clubs for the end of the season, which is a massive boost for them. But financially at the moment, we cover the national leagues. Ben Mercer's obviously played at that level and in the Championship. Well, these clubs are really struggling at the moment. And even at the Premiership level, that's the case. So the cost for these tests is something that I think they are very, very wary of, because of, like you said, that 200 quid being the cheapest one is not really that cheap when you have to test all those players and staff and et cetera, et cetera. I know the RPA have said they're doing everything possible at the moment. I think they said yesterday in an article in the Times that they're doing everything possible. And it's actually quite refreshing that the RFU have had their medical officer involved with these conversations. The Premiership clubs' medical officers are now coming into these conversations. And as you said, Ben, that, you know, the Premiership football has been quick to act. There's been decisiveness in terms of how they get players back to training. And I think with rugby, now we're hearing that medical officers are getting involved, that is of such a positive step. Because for me, from the outside, it looked like these decisions were only being talked about in the boardroom and people in suits having a chat over Zoom. Whereas now you're getting the experts in. I think that is a positive step.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's worth saying we ultimately don't know what's going on behind the scenes. And I'm sure there are, you know, there's constant chat behind the scenes about how they're going to do this. So, you know, I don't think there's not anything being done. It is just slightly surprising that we haven't heard a little bit more about it in contrast, for example, to football. But equally, I think it's a bigger undertaking for rugby. I read this morning that there's been a study done or some data showing that in a professional football match, the amount of time a player would come in, if one player on one of the teams had COVID, the amount of time that the other players would come into contact with them, as in sort of within 2 meters of them, on average across the game, it was only 39 seconds. Because ultimately football is less sort of contact heavy than rugby, obviously. So you would imagine that if it's that amount of time, it's probably for football, it's going to be more for rugby. And just the amount of contact and close contact that rugby has, you know, mauls, rucks, scrums, it's a lot more than football. So that's going to be another challenge. It is harder for rugby than it is for football.
Definitely. So, and we've obviously seen the football kind of having a bit of, especially in the UK, having some false starts with players testing positive for COVID as well, which is obviously pushing back their return to play. One of the big things, obviously, is player welfare, and player welfare covers more than just physical. It's, you know, their mental states, their financial states, which, you know, obviously are going to be affected because of a lack of playing, which means that some of them have been furloughed and all that kind of stuff. Ben C, as I'm going to refer now, because I'm going to get confused again at some point. You know, it's what do you think are the main issues with player contracts and stuff? Because obviously we've seen that players, you know, they're due to go to other clubs at some point in the near future this summer, and there's going to be some crossover there, it would seem.
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge amount of potential contractual issues at the moment on the player welfare side, with regard to how the risks are managed with COVID and government guidance requires there to be like the option for players to opt out, and employers have a duty of care to their players to make sure that the environment they're going to be playing and training in is safe. And that, you know, that's ultimately, like you mentioned, what are their fears? One of their fears is that a player gets, you know, let's take worst case scenario, one of the players gets COVID-19 and ultimately dies. Then, you know, there's a potential legal claim against the club. Then they're going to be worried about insurance. But on the sort of player movement side of things and the contractual concerns there, the player contracts, as I'm sure Ben Mercer will know, so they end on the 30th of June each year. That's the sort of the cycle, is 1st of July to 30th of June, at least normally. And so under contract, players whose deals are up at the end of this year will no longer be tied to their existing club. And their new employer will be the new club who they contracted with, essentially, that they were going to be starting with from the next season, which is the 1st of July. So let's take the example of Carl Sinclair moving from Quinns to Bristol. On the 1st of July, he will become an employee of Bristol Rugby Club. So he will no longer be a Quinns player. But then there's the added complication of the RFU's own regulations. I think it's RFU Regulation 14 deals with player registration. And then you've got the Premiership regulations, which deal with player eligibility for selection. And clubs aren't able to register players to play in the league until the start of the next season, because there's essentially a cut-off date each season. And the date is in, I believe, in April. So now that we're past April, but still in the 2019-20 season, essentially the transfer deadline has passed. So these players, although they will become the employees of their new club, they actually, under existing regulations, are not able to be registered to play by their new club because we're still in the old season. They could only be registered to play from next season. So that means that although Carl Sinclair would move from Quinns to Bristol, he wouldn't actually be eligible to play for Bristol until the start of next season. that's the position that we're in at the moment, if that makes sense. I hope I've explained that sufficiently clearly. But that could be subject to change. The RFU could change the regs and essentially move the transfer deadline day, making an exception to the normal rule, which would be the sensible thing to do, I think. But that's the position we're in. Players will move, but they're not currently eligible to play, which seems to be being underplayed in the media at the moment.
I think there was quite a good example where if you were able to move and you were eligible to play immediately, then I think Sam Hill could play against Exeter in the semi-final, despite having been a big part of Exeter for however many years, and he could actually, you know, be in a semi-final against them pretty quickly. But yeah, you're exactly right. There's kind of the move of the contract, and there's the registration, which often is a kind of slower process in some respects. It takes a little while to come through every now and again, and yeah, there'd be all sorts around that, I'm sure.
My only real kind of follow-up to that is who is liable to be playing the wages of the player if they're representing a different club? Would Bristol be paying Kyle Sinclair whilst he's representing Quinns against maybe even Bristol?
Well, I think he'd sit down, right? Because I think that's what they're suggesting. It's like he's like, I'm not going to jeopardise this contract I've signed by playing for somebody I no longer am employed by.
Yeah, so he would become, for all intents and purposes, he would become a Bristol player. He'd become an employee of Bristol. He would no longer be an employee of Harlequins. So presumably he would not continue to play for Quinns, and Bristol would pay his wages, but they just wouldn't be able to play him, because of course during this period of the year normally he wouldn't be playing for them, so that you know, the wages would still continue, but there'd be no eligibility.
There we go. For Ben M now, all I have written down in front of me right now is contracts in France differ, which is your area of expertise in many ways. So how do they differ?
France does certainly differ in many respects, but in terms of contracts, as far as I'm aware, I think some clubs have negotiated pay cuts across the board for all their employees and maybe a slightly separate rate for players. So I think that tends to be sort of 15-20%. And then all their employees also are going on sort of employment partiel or something, which is kind of their furlough scheme, a bit like a sort of chômage, I suppose, where, you know, they're not allowed to engage in any work and all the rest. And I think they can claim up to 5,000 euros a month per employee. Obviously, for some club employees, they won't go up to that amount, and maybe some of the younger players, but top 14 with some big salaries, that's not going to cover that much of someone's monthly salary. I think, you know, when the top guys are kind of 45,000-50,000 euros a month, you know, that's quite a small bit. I think the one thing is that maybe we'll touch on a little bit more is that actually a lot of clubs are just not doing their recruitment. So any time you've seen somebody sign, which in France does tend to happen a little bit later than over here anyway. So you see, you know, Kurtley Beale and Luke Jones have signed for Racing, and those deals must have been completed actually quite some time ago. And what a lot of clubs are doing, they're like, well, you know, we can't press on with our recruitment because we don't know, you know, how much money we're going to have coming in. We don't know anything. And there's things around Champions Cup as well. So this is obviously talking about the top level, but it just means there's a whole kind of glut of players who are in sort of contract insecurity, whether that's here, whether that's in France across divisions, whether that's in South Africa, whether, you know, they kind of gave people a sort of period of grace to opt out of their contract, whether that's Australia, where I think because they didn't sign a TV deal, you know, that their chief exec's gone. So there was a TV deal on the table, which as is yet sort of unsigned. And now that the pandemic's hit, that TV deal is going to be drastically reduced. So I think there's a lot of Australian players who would potentially be looking for a contract. So I think for the clubs, as far as the things they'll sort of do are sort of cut costs as much as they can and take advantage of any sort of furlough scheme. And then actually, particularly with the French teams, they'll have a real glut of unemployed players to select from potentially. So yeah, I, as far as I'm aware, that's how that's going. And that's the same top 14 and Pro D2 are run by the same governing body, and they've canned both seasons. So top 14's over, and Pro D2 has been over for a few. I think they actually cancelled both at the same time.
And just to jump in, Joe, if you don't mind, just to back to Ben Mercer, but in terms of the sort of the player welfare thing, obviously you've played in Championship and National League level. Do you sympathise with some of these players at the moment who may be out of contract or their contract's up in the air at that level? Because as you just rightly say there, we don't know what's going to happen, especially for these clubs who may not have a future in the next sort of 6 months.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really insecure career path anyway. So, I mean, like I write about it a little bit in my book, but there's kind of quite a lot of contracts are less than a year. So they might be 11-month contracts, and the sort of this time of the year, you will tend to, you know, be involved with the club, but maybe that insecurity's gone on longer. Championship had its funding cut anyway. So those teams are obviously looking to, you know, pre-pandemic, they were looking to kind of cut player salaries in the first place. And it's just not a good spot to be in. I've heard some pretty outrageous stories, which I think somebody was telling me that the Championship players, some of them were using things like OnlyFans to top up their income, which, given some of the characters I know in the Championship, some people might have actually enjoyed that. But I think, you know, that's kind of how insecure these guys are, because like a lot of them are living like month to month. They've got outgoings, they've got mortgages, and they're looking for part-time work, or that, you know, might be looking for a next gig. It's pretty difficult.
I'd like to see the Telegraph report that Championship players are using OnlyFans to generate an income.
I heard about that about 3 weeks ago and just didn't believe it, and now it's true.
Well, I don't. Yeah, it's just what I've heard. So.
Just what you've heard. No one look at Ben's finances, please. Speaking of finances, we've hit the jackpot that is the salary cap, and then Saracen's conversation that we've scheduled in for this one now. So salary cap, everything with that seems to be very interesting. Lord Miner's report recently, they're looking like they're going to scrap the marquee player scheme. Ben C, I know you've written a bit about this. So what would the changes be, and how would they affect like teams with their operations? Because I know Bristol aren't exactly thrilled.
Well, yeah. So the miners report is pretty extensive. I think it makes about 52 individual recommendations on what needs to change in the regs. And I'm not about to start telling you about all of them. Don't worry. But I think the marquee player one is the one that's got sort of most people's backs up. Well, those who are concerned by it anyway. So Bristol, for example. And Lord Miner's, his remit wasn't to address the level of the salary cap. It was more looking at the way that the regulations function and whether they achieve their aims. But as part of that, he recommends that Premiership Rugby reviews the player, so that the marquee player exemption. And so this doesn't mean that the marquee player rule is going to definitely disappear. He hasn't said in absolute terms, if you're going to adopt my recommendations, get rid of it. But he has recommended that they have a second think about it, basically. I think that would be a very difficult thing to do, to remove the marquee player. You could not do it overnight, because for a start, players are under contract and could be under contract for a significant period of time. And essentially, the marquee player rule makes the salary cap about 2 million, let's say 2 million roughly, more than the 7 million cap. It makes a cap around 9 million. So if you take those away, you've essentially got to reduce 9 million worth of salaries potentially into 7 million. And with contracts in place, that's not going to be easy to do. So however they do this, it's going to have to be some sort of phased out reduction. But whether or not it's actually a good idea from a business perspective as well, I'm yet to be convinced by it, because I feel like the marquee players probably add quite a lot to the Premiership in terms of what the product looks like, what the Premiership rugby product looks like. So I think there's a lot of questions to be asked there.
I think the problem with the salary cap and the marquee player exemption, in sort of my view, it's not necessarily about the finances, you know, and like you say, it's great for the product. You get guys like Simi Radradra coming to Bristol, like everyone wants to see that, you know, like I suppose opponents don't really want to, but you know, like I think any supporter would. I think it's more a kind of comparative issue in that when you sign a guy on that money, it just stretches the compensation for the other players, because obviously if you're an England player, for instance, or if you're kind of one of the senior players there, you're looking at what one of these marquee guys is getting, and you can't help but have that become a benchmark for you. So I think that's been the problem, and what that's really done, and I did bang on about this a little bit, but it's really hollowed out the middle of those Premiership squads. So it's a real have and have nots. You almost create a bit of an NFL scenario where you get a top end of the squad on kind of sort of bigger contracts than are really sustainable. And it just means there's a constant churn at this lower end of young guys, guys in the Championship, kind of guys on short-term deals. And actually it sort of hollows out this middle of the squad. So yeah, I think with the marquee player, it's not a kind of, the main problem with it isn't any sort of, it's not necessarily that it in itself is financially unsustainable or that it's unethical or anything like that. I think it's more that it sort of gives everyone a sort of false benchmark of what salaries are and aren't possible for the other players in the squad.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And perhaps, I mean, I don't know what you think, perhaps making the salary cap higher and then getting rid of the marquee rule might help that, because then, you know, clubs could spend that same amount of money, but perhaps because the you know, potential 2 million, let's just say, because it's never going to be more than that, wouldn't have to just go to two players. They could perhaps divide that up amongst a group of four, say. So you'd have four players earning 500k each, for example. Do you think that might be something that would be a better option than getting rid of it entirely?
I think in some ways, yes. But I think the good thing about the marquee player exemption is that you can't go and sign someone from another team in the league and have them count as your marquee. Isn't that the case? So it kind of, it means that those exemptions are used to sign talent from elsewhere. Yeah. Actually, perhaps the solution might be to offset, almost kind of provide a loyalty exemption. So maybe after, if someone's played for a club for, say, 5 years, then if you could offset a portion of their salary, then, you know, you're keeping the kind of guys who are sort of at a club for a long time and rewarding loyalty and providing kind of experience, all the sort of other benefits that go with a player of that kind of caliber. But you're also freeing up money, which you can then kind of either go high or low with, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that would be a better idea.
Yeah, that certainly makes sense. I mean, I think it's clear that because of the potential complexities that we're fleshing out here, that this issue needs a sort of, I'm not saying a full review of its own, but it does need some serious looking into before they make a decision. It shouldn't be something they just try and do quickly. They need to have a serious think about the best way to approach the issue.
Agreed.
Just on that, Ben, C, as well, in terms of bringing it back to sort of the here and now, I guess salary caps with the players potentially moving to one club to another is a bit of a minefield as well. We use Sinclair as an example, but would his salary cap now be changed? Because would Bristol's salary cap now be changed because Sinclair comes in, or is that still awaiting any sort of guidance from PRL on that?
Well, if the sort of contractual end date, so let's say the 30th of June end date stays the same, then there shouldn't really be any major issues with the salary cap, because the salary cap year also runs from 1st of July to 30th of June. So if Sinclair moves as he was supposed to move on the 1st of July, then his salary will then fit into Bristol's salary cap for the next year, as it would have done anyway. The only issue will happen, the only issue that will arise will be if players' contracts get extended, because just to finish this season. So let's say there's a player whose deal is coming to an end at the end of this year, but they haven't got a deal to go to for next season yet. And maybe because of the crisis, they're not going to get one. Their current club might just want to extend their current contract so that they have that player available until they get to the end of this campaign, whenever that may be. So that then becomes difficult, because presumably the club won't have budgeted for that player's salary in next year's salary cap, i.e. from the 1st of July onwards. So if that's something that starts to happen, clubs might find it difficult to fit those salaries into the cap. Whether we then see some sort of dispensation granted under the cap regulations to account for that, I don't know. That's something that PRL would have to address. But equally, because we've seen the pay cuts, And if there is this sort of 25% reduction across the board, that might actually allow the clubs to fit in sort of those extra months of players being under contract, those extra months of salary, because ultimately everyone's being paid a bit less, and so their wiggle room under the cap might be more. Yeah, basically, we have to wait and see what happens on that one.
Now to everyone's favourite topic, Saracens. So obviously they're being used as a case study in this example. Obviously, so they've been, well, for lack of a better word, they've been pushed into the Championship by the end of it with a consistent points reductions by the end of the season. So obviously they have to complete, they have obligations to complete the Premiership season. I mean, this is basically saying what happens with promoting relegated teams this season that haven't had their leagues confirmed. So Saracens is pretty much the only one in this country where they have obligations now to complete a Premiership season as well as to compete in a Championship season. So what's going to happen with them, because they have players that are due to join other teams on loan, like Nick Adikwe, who joined Saints this morning?
I think it's a bit of a minefield again, isn't it? I think I've used that term a lot so far, but there is, I know that Ollie Slaughter at the time said that there is a possibility the Saracens could play two games in two different leagues, depending on how long the Premiership season goes on for and when they decide to bring the Championship back. So that again, this is kind of going to the point of how do you fit in all these fixtures with a rugby calendar that's already absolutely cram-packed, and then throwing a Lions tour next year on top of it. And it goes back to the player welfare stuff that we were talking to Ben Mercer about before. And it's, you've got to look at from their perspective first and foremost. I think with this whole kind of period we're in, player welfare is the most important thing in it all. And I know rugby financially is really struggling, but these players are part of the main reason why we love the game. So this has to be taken into consideration, and it's something that needs to be talked about. But I guess it all depends on what Premiership Rugby say. They say we need to complete the season and games can't start until whatever it is, the end of July. And they want to cram in 9 regular fixtures plus the playoffs and the final. You're looking at September, October time. And if Championship clubs do want to return to training, because you now are allowed to return to contact training, sorry, then there's going to be a crossover at some point. So again, it's like, as Ben C just said, it's a wait and see kind of thing.
Yeah, and the same with regard to players moving on loan and things like that, the same points would apply as we've been just discussing about contract dates and things. It will all depend on what dates they put in those deals, which, you know, you would assume would be the normal season dates. But now we know that, you know, play's probably not going to happen for a while. Maybe they've actually agreed to put the contract in terms of the 2020-2021 season rather than 1st of July to 30th of June, for example. They might have actually said, okay, Nick Azikwa, you can go on loan to Northampton and the deal will start when next season starts rather than on the 1st of July, perhaps. I don't know. This is just speculation. But, you know, you're right. The seasons could well overlap. Whether the RFU would actually step in to delay the start of the Championship season might be something that would be worth considering, because I think, obviously, having Saracens competing in two leagues at once would be pretty untenable.
I think as well, if you are Saracens, and I realise that you are obliged to probably do this, but I don't see what the incentive would be to complete the Premiership season. You're like, well, you know, we're kind of risking our assets. We've already been relegated. You know, like, there's obviously, I'd have thought, a fair bit of ill will. I don't think there'd be much incentive for them to play. So you wonder if maybe the best solution for the Premiership season is to almost, you know, call final standings, and maybe play the kind of playoff element of it to find a winner. I don't know, obviously, but I just see that, you know, making Saracens play in two competitions, who do they put in each one? It just seems, yeah, like you say, completely untenable. And the other thing is they have no incentive to do that. So, yeah, I'm not sure.
The only thing I would say with regards to their incentive is, like you said, they would be obliged to do it under the Premiership regulations, and also they'll want to receive the broadcast money. And I would imagine that there'd be some part of their deal they have with Premiership Rugby that says, you know, you have to fulfil your fixtures to get your share of the broadcast revenue. And so if they, let's say that because I wondered about that as well. You know, the idea that maybe that Premiership rugby could just cut Saracens out of it at the point that the Championship starts, and maybe just sort of annul those fixtures, and award 5 points or 4 points to the team they were supposed to be playing, for example. That would be, there'd be issues with that as well. But also cutting Saracens out would potentially deprive Saracens of some of their revenue. So I think Saracens would very much want to complete this season, and also their sponsorship deals as well would be compromised.
I think in France because they called it final standings, and they've basically frozen any promotion and relegations. They've gone, right, that's not happening. And there was a suggestion that they were going to promote two teams into Pro D2 and then relegate nobody but that would make the league bigger. So that was rejected. I think, yeah, they've actually frozen promotion and relegation for a year, I believe.
Yeah, I think the RFU with the lower leagues adopted the sort of best playing record formula. And I suppose the fact that the Saracen salary caps sort of situation happened this year makes it, in a way, easier, because it means Saracens are automatically relegated. They have to go down. There's sort of an agreement in place that they will go down. But on the other hand, it makes it harder, because if there hadn't been that rule in place, then they probably could have just sort of frozen promotion relegation, perhaps. It would perhaps have been more straightforward in that respect.
That's poor, even bring into account them wanting to defend the Champions Cup that they won last year in Newcastle as well. So, yeah, that's going to be an interesting situation. And then, kind of, obviously, Ben C, I've seen that you've written recently about the rescheduling of Six Nations games and things like that. Obviously, recent announcements, Six Nations and Sanzar are talking about aligning calendars. Are we just going to write off Autumn Internationals this year and presume that maybe they're going to stay a bit more in the Northern Hemisphere and maybe try and complete Six Nations games instead of trying to fly people around the world?
Yeah, I mean, that's been the suggestion, isn't it? I think with the travel restrictions in place, particularly in the Southern Hemisphere countries, whether or not they'd want to send teams over, and then if they could keep them in sort of an isolated bubble, I'm not sure if that would be practical at all. And then, of course, you've got the issues of match day stadiums and bringing fans into stadiums, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I don't know if that's going to go ahead. It's looking increasingly unlikely, but you never know if there's been reports that the vaccine could be coming out sooner than we thought, and if that happened, then perhaps they'd be able to do that, send their players over. But you know, that's very much speculation. And again, if they try, that could provide a window to play these Six Nations games, because that's the other issue, is that if the Autumn Internationals were to go ahead, when would we play the remaining Six Nations fixtures? Well, World Rugby's regulations specify release periods for players, so their clubs have to release them to play in international games, but only in the specified windows. And those windows are the Six Nations, as at the dates of the Six Nations, so basically February to March, and then the July, 3 weeks in July and 3 weeks in November. Outside of those, clubs wouldn't actually have to release the players. So let's say that the Six Nations wanted to play this game in August. Well, if the Premiership's up and running in August, then the clubs wouldn't want to do that, and they wouldn't have to do that. So perhaps if the Autumn Internationals don't happen, that November release period could actually be the sort of prime time to get those games played.
Learn something. I'm learning a lot in this podcast.
Ben sees a smart guy. I mean, just listen to him.
Yeah.
Ben sees that end. But this situation has thrown up a huge amount of issues. You know, it's almost unimaginable, sort of the number of things that are affected by this pandemic. And, you know, it's throwing up things that everyone's learning about every day, I think.
I think, Ben, if you could educate us some more, because I think it seems odd that rugby is in a much more precarious financial situation as an entire game than these other sports. Like, you know, football obviously has... you know, particularly the biggest teams, they've actually got a fair amount of run rate, as it were. And, you know, the American sports, they have a lot of run rate. And there was a bit of an arms race to see who could get back playing first, because, you know, obviously, you know, the Bundesliga is kind of back, and there's a few other smaller leagues that haven't been back. But with rugby, it's so pressing to figure this out. I mean, do you think that they could have moved quicker on it? Or, you know, like, it's really kind of exacerbating all these things that they've prevaricated on for quite some time, right?
Yeah, for sure. I just think they don't want to make a mistake, because rushing to get back and not doing it properly would be potentially catastrophic. I mentioned briefly earlier the point about, you know, what if a player did get COVID-19 and the worst happened? You've got all sorts of concerns there in terms of liabilities. So, you know, it would be difficult to prove that they caught it in the course of playing, for example. But if they could show that they caught it because of their employer, or that the employer sort of increased their chance of getting it because they didn't take sufficient care, then potentially that's a pretty big lawsuit against a club. And of course, normally if a club gets sued, they'd sort of turn to their insurers to pay out. But an insurance policy probably wouldn't cover ordinarily anything related to this pandemic, unless a club has specifically got a policy in place to deal with this sort of thing, which you'd imagine most of them wouldn't. So, you know, there was a lot of talk about clubs trying to get sort of some sort of coronavirus extension on their insurance policies. But of course, that's going to be pretty expensive. And I think this is probably one of the main sticking points. You know, Premier League clubs, for example, have got quite a lot of money, or at least their owners do, to fund the return to play in every sense. The potential insurance implications would be another cost for rugby to factor in. And given the sort of relatively precarious financial position that rugby's in, that's just another cost that's going to need to be accounted for. And that's probably something that's played a part in the delay. And then they were thinking about, well, can we get players to sign a waiver for any sort of claim? Well, you can't do that. That's you know, that wouldn't be valid legally. So that doesn't work. So instead, they're having to go through these all these sort of stage 1, stage 2 government protocols to put a plan in place. And I just think it's, you know, that's the main fear. The main fear is that something bad happens. And then they get held accountable for it. And so they're just trying to be as thorough as possible. But it's not easy, particularly given the high degree of contact that rugby inevitably involves.
And Ben Mercer, just to put sort of you in the shoes of a Premiership player, if you like, now when we talked about sort of Saras. Yeah, well, I think you could have played Premiership, Ben. So, but we talked about Saracens wanting to, you know, return to play for the commercial reasons. But if you were a player in the Premiership and you were, you know, there is talk about coming back, and as Ben says there is this fear that if one player gets it, then it could all fall apart. Would you have any sort of concerns about going back to playing if the protocols weren't in place?
Oh, of course, yeah. I'm sure they do. You know, you only have to turn the TV on, don't you, and see how serious it is. So I'm pretty certain you know the environment that you usually work in. And yeah, I'm sure they have those conflicting feelings because they'll have been cooped up, they'll have been working hard, you know, probably for the most part. And yeah, I'd have thought that they're really twitching to go and play. But yeah, you're not something that's dangerous anyway. You know, playing high-level rugby is really dangerous anyway. It doesn't really need to be any more dangerous than it already is. So, yeah, I'd have thought you would be really concerned about it. And, I mean, I think Joe brought up the Premiership, maybe the Watford guy tested positive the other week, didn't he? And he was like, well, I haven't left, you know, barely done anything. I don't know how this has happened. And, you know, it's pretty easily done, let alone, yeah, if you're all kind of sweating and scrumming and mauling and doing all the rest. So, yeah, I'd have thought they'd be really concerned about it.
One of the things that I didn't realise probably how much clubs relied on this, like the gate receipts in particular, because I think something like every Twickenham match day, the RFU earns £10 million or something ridiculous like that when you think there's 80,000 in there. God, I mean, a pint of beer is £6. But obviously, you know, £10 million match days, the RFU's losing out on probably what, two, three, four, about 7 to 8 match days potentially this year at Twickenham, so what, 80 million? And then that covers the losses that they were projected to make at the start of COVID-19. It's bizarre that in, you know, 2020, 24, 25 years of the game being professional, that we're still so reliant on fans, and then we're facing this likelihood that games are going to be played behind closed doors in the near future.
I mean, I think the game will always be reliant on fans. I think, you know, the fans are ultimately... That's why the sport exists. If we didn't have fans, then wouldn't it be any professional sport. I think the other one is broadcast revenues, as I mentioned before. That's obviously a massive part. And so that really is why they're trying so hard to get games back, even if it's going to be behind closed doors, just so that they can get, you know, most, if not all, of the broadcast money. Because without that, and without any match day revenue, which is pretty much you know, guaranteed not to happen for the foreseeable future, they would really be in big trouble.
Yeah, I think as well, I'd completely echo that in saying that, you know, the fan interest is what drives, you know, is the reason it exists. But I think the other thing, and I mean, football's definitely seen it with moving kickoff times around to suit broadcasters. But what you've seen from the Bundesliga is that actually a live broadcast with no fans there is a sort of really odd and very suboptimal viewing experience. So it's like, well, you know, the fans have always been deprioritized in favor of broadcasters, you know, for the most part. But actually, I think this situation really highlights how important the fan presence at the game actually is. So, yeah, it's incredible, really, that it makes you sort of, it's something you always sort of knew is really thrown into kind of sharp relief.
Yeah, there's also, there's another potential legal issue that I know there's legal issues everywhere. I'm sort of saying that every other sentence at the moment. But, you know, there's been talk in the Premier League about, well, if the games can be televised, but they're not going to be with fans, and maybe we're going to have to move them around and play them at different times of day. Well, does that devalue what the broadcaster paid for originally? You know, does that make it, like you say, a suboptimal viewing experience? Why should, does the broadcaster have to pay the full sum that they were originally going to pay, or can they essentially get a reduction? And I think that there's been a suggestion in the Premier League that there could be that sort of a reduction in the amount that's owed because of these changed circumstances. I think Liverpool, there was an article out this morning actually, that Liverpool were going to argue that no, you know, it doesn't change it sufficiently. You know, the product you're still going to be selling on TV is going to be much the same. But it raises an interesting debate about whether, you know, like you say, Ben, whether the fans are actually crucial to the broadcast product itself.
Quite ironic for a broadcaster to make that point, having, you know, roughshod over travelling away fans, you know, come down from Liverpool to London for a Friday 7 p.m. kickoff or whatever, and then suddenly turn that around on the club. Like, it'd be a bit much. I mean, maybe there's a way of innovating around the broadcast, so giving them better access in the week to the club environment, or I don't know, like match day, kind of better match day access or something like that. But those are just, you know, wild ideas. They're not that.
There was also some talk about playing pre-recorded fan noises, I think.
Ooh, terrible.
But I think that was rejected pretty swiftly.
I did see something that looked quite good, that would be very possible at Racing in the spaceship anyway. But it was the sort of screen end to have fans on Zoom. Or, you know,
yeah, in Denmark, are they doing that or something?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I think that was it. And you'd hear some noise, but obviously, you know, I know normally there might be some unsavoury noise, but you could really hear something or see something quite spectacular that's coming from someone's living room.
to be a regulator.
Just jump in, Jar. I mean, we talked about before about the product being these marquee players and marquee signings, but the fans are part of that product, aren't they? And I think they play such an important part. And you're telling me that Exeter won't want their fans in, and Gloucester's fans don't make an impact on a Friday night at King's Old. You would be wrong to say that, because they play such a massive part in it, and it is going to be very, very strange. We touched on the Bundesliga there. It is going to be weird to see rugby behind closed doors, but it's kind of the least important things are the important things, having fans in the stadium at the moment. And it is part of the product. It's interesting to see, as Ben C touched on, how the broadcasters are going to react to that bit. Yeah, it's just going to be a very strange experience, because we've seen football do it. I don't think any of us have probably seen rugby play behind closed doors unless it's a local game with two men and his dog there.
I was going to say, Chris, I've played loads of games.
I do want to say that.
You know, some of those games, you know, mostly some of those games might as well have been. I was just going to say, touching on what you said, that actually really interesting with the Bundesliga, and I know it's not a big sample size, but I think, out of all the games they've played, I think only 20% have been won by the home team. And I think you're right. Like,
really?
It's like, you know, without...
That's mad.
That must be a big factor, you know, somewhere like Gloucester, you know, where they're really on top of you and all the rest. You know, like, if they're not there, then it takes away a big kind of fear factor, or a big thing you have to deal with. I know professional players are professional players, but it's still obviously a bit of an advantage.
Would that change your mentality, Ben? If you were playing at a home game, would you be like, well, this is strange? Would that throw you off course, do you think?
I don't think it would. I don't think it would kind of consciously. I think maybe because you'd be used to running out there and sort of seeing and hearing certain cues, then those cues not being there would probably affect you. But I don't think it would really change your mentality in terms of your preparation, in terms of what you're thinking about. But yeah, I think it would just obviously be unfamiliar to you, whereas normally, obviously, you're at a familiar environment.
Do you think that as a result of, let's be honest, we've been starved of live sport for the best part of 3 months now. And do you think that there'll be more interest in people watching sport and like buying subscription services like BT and I'm trying to think of the other ones that do sport, obviously like Amazon Prime, they've started doing a lot more sports coverage. Do you think people will be subscribing to these things more so that they can watch the sports? Maybe that it's not even their first sport, maybe it's not even their second sport, but to be given live sports action, because I mean, I've had a real hankering to watch UFC recently. I've never watched it before in my life.
I think perhaps while there's only sort of one or two sports actually on, that might be true. But of course, you've got to remember that the longer this goes on, the more cash-strapped a lot of people will feel. And if there is a sort of global or at least national economic downturn, which there inevitably is going to be, the longer this continues, that will obviously impact on broadcasters' own incomes.
I think something that could potentially happen, like you said, like it's a time where you're almost looking to watch anything. And that's part of the advantage in trying to get back quickly, whatever sport that was. But I think there was like a celebrity golf game the other day, which was like Tiger Woods and Tom Brady and Phil Mickelson and somebody else. And Tom Brady was terrible for the first half of it. And then he played. But you wonder in rugby whether, just to get a bit of, interest, whether they get right, having George Ford and Farrell kicking competition on Instagram Live or whatever, you just get some sort of little things going around. Stuff like that. I don't know if that would be just a fun little way of getting a few things in front of people, but
yeah, it certainly would be. That actually just makes me think of another point that I meant to make when we're talking about the delay, is that if you do something like that and you get the players in to sort of do things for either TV or for Instagram, whatever, with the club, then if you currently furloughed those players, then that actually brings them back to work. And I meant to mention this before, was that that's another one of the major considerations about when players come back to training. And so if they sort of get this guidance in place and the protocols in place and bring them back, then they ultimately can't use the furlough scheme anymore. So that's another major consideration for the clubs, particularly if they're worried about their finances, is that the longer they can actually keep the players on furlough, the more money they've got coming in from government, or the more money they're able to claim back from government. So that's going to be another factor in deciding when is the right time to bring the players back.
I think Premiership Rugby, as I said at the top, that Darren Charles has said that he wanted Premiership Rugby to be the first live sport in the UK back on television. But because of what we've just discussed for the last sort of 50 minutes or so, it's difficult to rush rugby back, and the risks outweigh the positives of bringing it back. But I think still the drive from Premiership Rugby will be to get the sport back on TV, because it can only help grow the sport. And we've talked about how much it's struggling financially. And if you do get more fans involved, that will possibly help in the long run. So it definitely is a case of Premiership would be going, okay, these risks are far more important, but if we can get it back on the telly and get people who may not have watched a game of rugby in their life before talking and watching this rugby on BT Sport, it's only going to help.
Yeah, it's certainly a massive balancing act. I think everything at the moment is, and like I said, they've got to weigh up the advantage of that, getting it back and being one of the only sports on TV, and yet that might attract a new audience. But at the same time, looking after the players, looking after the clubs, making sure they can get the right support from government, making sure they've got their insurance in place, and ultimately that will protect the players as well, and making sure everyone's comfortable to play. Because as Ben said, plenty of players might be reluctant about returning, and certainly under the stage one of the government guidance, it made clear that there needs to be made clear that there's an opt-out option for elite athletes, and presumably under the second stage of guidance, there must be also an opt-out. So massive balancing act.
Now we're going to just end this before some self-promo for everyone that's come on, because we do really appreciate your time. What would be your way to end this season? Would you just null and void it? Would you use a playoff system, or what would you want to do? We'll start with Ben M.
Yeah, I think, like I said, I'd probably take the top four and be like, right, bang, you know, one ground, you know, at Twickenham, maybe like semi-final, final, there we are, champion, thank you very much. Everybody else can, you know, just get fit, stay safe and all the rest of it, and get ready for the next year. I think that there doesn't seem a great deal of point in playing out 9 rounds of games, then playoffs or however many are left. So yeah, that's what I'd do.
I think I'd probably do similar. I can't see how they're going to fit in all the games. I think perhaps playing, sort of implementing some sort of best playing formula to work out the final standings before then taking the top four, or maybe even doing like a top six, truncated little round robin tournament or playoff system, to work out the winner would be good. But I agree with Ben. I think it's going to be difficult to do the full season, particularly given that the clubs haven't returned to training yet.
Yeah, I think that is a very key point, Ben. These clubs haven't returned to training yet. We're so far down the road now, it's tough to see how you're going to fit in 9 rounds of fixtures, of playoffs and the final. I think, you know, we talked about the leagues below being canned. I think it might have been an easy decision for the RFU to make, because you look in National 1, which we cover, in National 2, they only had 5 games left. It's quite easy to write points per game, end the season there. Well, you might, you know, that kind of was the easy decision for them to make, if you like. So I'd agree. I think you do have to sort of look at a playoff system. I think the top six might be a really good point. You know, Champions Cup places there, or competing for that same prize to lift the Premiership title at Twickenham, hopefully. So yeah, do something similar to that. And I think because the World Cup was on as well, we are in this situation. We probably would be further down the season, but because the World Cup happened, we are where we are. So I think the only option to fit everything in and sort of tick the box of this season is sort of a shortened playoff kind of aspect.
Yeah, definitely, definitely, definitely. Right, okay, we'll do self-promo time to end it all. Well, so who wants to go first?
I've got nothing to promote, so I like the two Bens.
The Looseheads podcast, Chris. The Looseheads podcast.
Okay.
Sean Edwards the other day.
Yes, we did, yeah. He was good.
I'll go first, because I'll let Ben finish by selling his book, but I have far less to promote. I write a blog called Rugby on the Law. You can find it online at www.rugbyinthelaw.com, on Twitter at Rugby in the Law, and on Facebook Rugby in the Law. But that's all I'm selling. Over to you, Ben.
I'm selling nothing apart from my ongoing friendship, the loss of my role at TIU at the beginning of this podcast, and new friendship with Ben, obviously. But yeah, I have actually written a book. It's called Fringes: Life on the Edge of Professional Rugby. It's available on Amazon. If you've read it already, like, thank you very much. And yeah, feel free to send me a message. Love hearing from people. Had loads of funny stories from people involved, you know, their own kind of rugby anecdotes and stuff. So if you've got anything like that, then feel free to give me a shout. Find me on Twitter, on my website, benmercer.me. Yeah, there you are.
In terms of the Looseheads podcast show, if you want me to remember that, we teamed up with the Mental Health Foundation Looseheads recently, just to kind of promote the message of, you know, it's okay not to be okay, and tackle the stigma around mental health and rugby. And the guys there do brilliant job, and it's sort of nice to work in that aspect of rugby rather than interviewing players and getting news lines and stuff like that. So we've been privileged to, they've got some great contacts to get people on the podcast and talk to them about sort of why they're involved with the foundation and why it's important to talk about mental health, but also go into sort of the careers and funny anecdotes and stuff like that. So it's been brilliant to sort of add that to our bow over the last sort of over this lockdown period. So yeah, keep an eye on that for NCIU over Spotify and all the other podcast apps that are available.
And I have nothing. So all that's really left to say is thank you very much for listening to this Talking Rugby Union podcast. Many thanks to the Bens. I think that's just simpler for me. I think just to say that to the Bens. Their social media links will be embedded at the bottom of the podcast, as well as on probably the social media tweet that you found this on. And yeah, thank you very much for listening, and I'm sure you'll hear us next time.